Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good morning. My name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic. And it's a blessing and a privilege to be here. You guys definitely got the short end of the stick. You're out there and you're stuck with this, and I'm up here and I get all this, which is wonderful. Now, as far as the handouts go, a little disclaimer. First of all, you won't be able to follow along with what I'm doing with the handouts. These are for people like me that when you lay out all these instructions, you get a hard time visualizing everything. The outside cover has all the charts, and these, again, are visualizations. They're to help if your sponsor is anything like mine was or like Bill over there in the wheelchair. They will tell you that these forms represent check mark sobriety, and it's usually suggested you use white paper and black ink and make your own columns. But this allows me to see exactly how it's laid out in the book in a visual form. And, again, I'm not going to be going through all that in a 25-minute presentation. That's about all I could do. Okay, what I'm going to be talking about are some of the observations, and I'm going to be going through in the big books certain sections between page 64 and 71. And what we've done so far is step one, we've realized we have a problem. Step two, we at least had a strong suspicion that there was some help out there from a power greater than ourselves. And then we begin with step three. The prayer that we did was a decision. And the book says, though our decision was a vital and a crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that in ourselves which have been blocking us. And it's the principle behind the Oxford Group and AA to understand that my inability to help other people and be happy in my own skin is because there are things blocking me from God and blocking me from other people. It was explained to me that in the book, most of the time when you do a prayer, it ends with an amen. It was explained to me that when you begin the third step prayer, that everything up until the seventh step prayer is all one prayer. And what that means is, for me, what I come to understand is from that point on, if I really mean that third step prayer, from then on, I've got a new sponsor. Besides the guy that's helping me, I've got a new sponsor. And that new sponsor is God. And that's where I get the power to go forward and get through this stuff. Because based on my own power, I can't do this inventory, this house cleaning, and make amends. It says, our liquor is but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. So the four-step inventory is to make me aware of the causes and the conditions. And the primary cause, the root of my problem, is my selfishness. Okay, and the conditions are the harms that I do and the separation I talked about, the separation I have from myself and God, the separation between me and other people. When we were talking about, Lee was talking about the first step. He talked about being alone. And that's the causes and conditions that result in my selfishness. It says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding, fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about our stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged and unsellable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. What that's telling me is I need to set aside just about everything. A lot of the fact-finding that we're going to do here are going to be uncovering the lies that I tell myself. Okay, so I pray that God will set aside the things that I think I know and help me to understand what I need to know. And a good example that was shown to me about this is there can be some things that are absolutely okay for me to know and understand. An example of that is Jesus loves me. That can be absolute fact, and it can be very helpful to me. But sometimes, if I'm not in the right frame of mind, I can do the wrong thing with that, and I can go off on the right track. So I need to be willing to learn what I need to learn as I'm supposed to learn it through this process. We do exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self is the cause, like I talked about, which manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations, those conditions we talked about. And the other common manifestation is the lack of power. So when I get started on these four-step inventories and this fact-finding and fact-facing mission, one thing I need to remember is not to beat myself up. Okay? A lot of the things that some of us did, and me too, worked absolutely terrible. But what I come to realize is that in the condition that I was in, I lacked the power to do any better. So there's no reason for me to be beating myself up over what I did. It says here that resentment is the number one offender. It's explained to me that resentment is to refeel. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease. Okay, so what that tells me is that resentment is the granddaddy of spiritual diseases. It also tells me that resentment in and of itself is a spiritual disease. It's the manifestation of my allergy of the body. The obsession of my mind is manifesting as the spiritual disease, and resentment is at the root of it. The selfishness and the resentments are the granddaddy of spiritual diseases. Here's a promise. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. And some of you have heard my story, but I had a rather profound experience with the spiritual malady and the mental capacities coming back immediately. But I don't have time to share my story today. Okay, we're spiritually sick. When I'm spiritually sick, a couple of things are going on. Number one, I'm not teachable. And we already talked about I'm separated from God. I'm separated from other people. The reason I do this process of house cleaning is for the freedom that it's going to provide me. It says to put the inventory on paper. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. White paper, black ink, or in a pinch, black paper and white ink is okay too. Okay. A couple of things happen when I put it on paper. One of them is when it gets down on paper, it's real. Okay, it's out of my head and it's on paper. It actually makes it real. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relations, including sex, were hurt or threatened, so we were sore. Second thing that happens when I put them on paper. Usually, after I inspect them and I take a good look at them, what I find is most of it is very trivial. Most of the time, I overdo things in my head. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Do I want to live like that? No. We began to see that the world and its people really dominate us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. So what's fancied and what's real? It was explained to me that if it involves me, it's probably fancy. Okay? What I'm doing is I'm allowing people to live inside my head, and they aren't even paying rent. And the reality is that we could not wish them away any more than we could wish alcohol away. I need to understand that of my own power, I'm stuck with the desire to drink, I'm stuck with the resentments, and I'm stuck with my character defects. The object of this thing is to get hooked up with God and get help with these issues, because the desire to drink just suddenly ceases. The character defects eventually just start to fall away. These are why we need our new sponsor, God, so we're not alone. Okay, we realize that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Now, if you're like me, you want to pronounce them spiritually sick, okay? It says here, perhaps. I don't get to pronounce other people spiritually sick, but I do need to observe that they might be. My perceptions and my expectations of others. Now, in hindsight, when I look back at what people did, most of the time what people do is absolutely predictable. Okay? No matter how bad something somebody does, in hindsight, it's absolutely predictable. What gives me the right to expect people to behave like I want them to behave? We ask God to help show them help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. If you go into a hospital to visit somebody that's dying, what can you do? You don't walk in and say, "How are you doing?" It's very simple. What can I do to help? If I can take that attitude with other people, even if I disagree with what they're doing, it helps me. And we avoid retaliation and argument. It says on page back on 80, on 84, says we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, because by this time sanity will have returned. These are the promises after the house cleaning. And for me, sanity is quite clearly what it is clarity of thought. Not fighting anything or anyone is sanity. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentments leads only to futility and unhappiness. Okay? It talks about wasting time. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. Now, did I really hear what that says? It doesn't say I drink again and I become insane. It says the insanity returns first and then I drink again. This inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we were willing to set these matters straight. Okay, these wrongs, we'll go through step five and on to our eighth step list. Now we move on to fear. Fear is a short word, somehow touches every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it, driven by 100 forms of fear, back on page 62. Okay, and we talked about this in the meeting Thursday night. Think about the limo that pulls out in front of the house first thing in the morning, and I walk out, and one of the limo drivers is fear. But there's more than one. There's 100 limo drivers. They're fear, selfishness, dishonesty. All these different things that drive me to do what I do on a daily basis, to hurt other people and to block me from God and others. It sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought us to misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. Did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Now, for a lot of us, me included, when I looked at this, it really didn't make sense to me. How can you classify fear with stealing? There's two different ways to look at this. Now remember, this book was written back in the 30s. They were coming off the Great Depression. People had very little. People were sometimes lucky to have water, to have anything to drink, for food, work. They didn't have anything. When you took from other people, you were taking away their hope. Okay? Classified with stealing. Another way to look at it is the reasons I have fear is because I'm not trusting God. When I have fear, I'm stealing from God His power to help me. Why do we have the fear? And this is what I'm talking about. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Perhaps there's a better way, and we think so. Going back to the third step prayer, for now we are on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. The calamities don't go away. We just get enough serenity to deal with them. Toby and I had this discussion in a car ride about trust and faith, and I kind of had it backwards. This is where this comes from. Trusting and relying on God. What's the difference? Some of you might remember being to the circus when you were little, and the guy's up on the high wire, and he's walking back and forth. And everybody's cheering, Yay, he's doing a great job. Then he gets a wheelbarrow. He's back across there again. Everybody's cheering. Everybody trusts that that guy's not going to fall down. Okay? But if you're willing to rely on him and get up there and get in the wheelbarrow, it's a big difference. Who's going to volunteer to get in the wheelbarrow and trust God? When I'm trusting and relying on God, the fear begins to go away and I outgrow it. We never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. Going back to what I said in the beginning, God's my new sponsor, and I need to begin to recognize that what my physical sponsor does to help me, I need to recognize that it's God working through him. And I want to get to the point that I can be used in the same manner. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. How many times did many of us read that and think that God was going to show us what to do? It's not what it says. God shows me who I'm supposed to be. And at once we begin to outgrow fear. If I'm focused on my mission to do for God and let God use through me, and I rely on God, the fear begins to fall. I actually begin to outgrow it. It doesn't go away. It keeps coming. Now, I want to talk about sex. It says in the book that we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? It also says that our sex powers are God-given. Right? Anybody ever come to the point where somebody tells you that, you know, if you're wondering what you're doing is okay or not, and you ask God, God, would you go there and do this with me? You know? And after a while, you get to the point where you can hear it in the back of your head. And you get to this part. And you say, God, will you go with me when I do this? And you could just hear that voice in the background in a loving way saying, oh, yeah. Our sex powers are God-given. Probably one of the most powerful things he ever created. But a lot of this inventory is about our conduct. We reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Who had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got all this down on paper and looked at it. Now, what we're really talking about when we're talking about sex problems are relationship problems. And from my own experience, many of you know me, I've been sober since 1984, got married in 1985. And I can tell you that my ability to get along with other people in the world, whether inside AA or outside AA, it begins with my relationship with God. It begins with my relationship with my wife. If all that is going as planned, if I'm being who I'm supposed to be, everything else outside of me goes just as well. But this inventory kind of separates here. There's a couple of different things happening. One of the things that we're doing is we're shaping a sound. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, which I said was a clarity of thought, and for the strength to do the right thing. In these handouts, I've included in the very centerfold a sex ideal. Okay? You don't hold it this way. You hold it this way. Okay? Now, this is a suggested ideal. A couple of things to think about when you go through this, and if you use this as a guide to create your own sex ideal. One of the things that was pointed out to me is when I get done with this, okay, and what I'm really writing in a sex ideal in this manner, it starts out, most of us write this about the kind of person that we want to be with, okay? We're shaping an ideal of the kind of relationship and the kind of partner we would like to have. But what I was told to do when you get done with all that, to turn it all around on yourself. Because these things that I want someone else to be, these are what I have to be first. Because if I'm not, it won't work. I can't have it unless I'm willing to be it. Okay. Come back in a minute to relationships. And the second thing that we're doing with this inventory is in a conduct inventory. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, and we are willing to straighten out the past if we can. And we go back to our previous resentment and fears inventory when they involved other people. And we start compiling a list of names of people that we have hurt. This part of this inventory is going to be used in our eighth step when we make our amends list. And we're going to be putting that together for our sponsor when we go through step five to compile our eight-step list. And that's how that part of the step divides off. Okay. Back to the value of relationships. In the very beginning, I talked about that third step prayer. I talked about getting connected to God. And the ability to communicate with other people, the ability to have a relationship with other people, gets me connected, gets me outside myself, gets me focused on what my next mission to be. If we're going through this process at a rapid clip, it's not going to be long before what's going to really help me stay sober is helping somebody else. So as my relationships with other people begin to grow and I get to the point where I can help someone else, then I have the ability to really do what I'm supposed to do in this program. Thanks.
Daniel, did a good job. Thank you so much. Hang on, let me see here. Tri-County Central Office 38th Anniversary Dinner and Speaker Meeting. I think I already did that one. Saturday, February 2nd. Hopefully everybody got that one. Looks like a good time. Also, afterwards, the 12-step workshop, Recover and Live, by the 164 Group. The complete workshop will be a 4-CD set, $20 afterwards. Just see our recording people over here, and they'll take care of you. Now, we just had a nice thing about the fourth step. Here to relate his own fifth step for us. Just kidding. I don't know if I want to hear that. Mr. Alex K.
All right. Hey, everybody. My name is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic. I hear Dan is going to be signing big books in the back. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but okay. So I'm supposed to talk about the fifth step here. First, let me relate some mistakes I made with the fifth step. I thought I was supposed to go to my first couple meetings and say my fifth step. That's not true. And then after that, I thought I was supposed to, you know, speak at a meeting and be the speaker and then say my fifth step. And I actually did that. I spoke at the meeting place, and I had already done my steps, but I was still confused. And I shared for about 10 minutes, and about minute two, I was already crying, and I couldn't even continue on any longer. So, hopefully I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. My fifth step, it's kind of funny. I got my sponsor on Christmas Eve, and I did most of my four step, my fifth step, my sixth step, my seventh step, and pretty much my eighth step on Valentine's Day. So there wasn't much gap in between my fourth step and fifth step, and that's because I procrastinated. My sponsor gave me a date, and he said, either you were going to do your fifth step that day or you need to get another sponsor, and that's what I needed. We went to his house. I met him there, and I thought there was going to be, like, I thought Toby was going to be there. I thought a whole bunch of other people were going to be there, and they were going to be there with candles and incense, and they were going to, like, do some weird thing. And that's not how it was. The fifth step is in the big book. It's in Into Action. It's the first, like, four pages. We read those pages together, and when it said to do something, we did it, you know? And what I found out is my sponsor wasn't some spiritual guru. He wasn't a lawyer. He wasn't a priest. He wasn't a therapist. He was another alcoholic, you know, and that was cool. In fact, my sponsor that I went through the steps with had never heard of Fifth Step before. You know, I was his first Fifth Step. So, you know, the reason I mention that is to show that this program works and you don't have to be an expert. You know, and we read the book, we started talking, we said a little prayer before we started going through my what I had written. And basically what we did is, you know, I had the columns listed, like Dan was talking about, and we read them across. And on some of them, he just said, what's the next resentment, you know, and we didn't even really talk about it because I could see my part. In other parts, you know, we would have had to really dig into it. Some parts, you know, he told me some experience that he had similar. And it was just two drunks talking together that happened to be sober, you know, and it was really a relief. Specifically on the resentment section, you know, I felt some freedom because for the first time, I told somebody like how much I felt like a victim and how much I felt like other people had victimized me. And for the first time, I could see my part in it, you know, and that was freeing. And another thing is, when I was telling him that stuff, he didn't like disappear and run. You know, I had already kind of like over our time, him sponsoring me, I kind of like let him know a couple things to see his reaction. You know, I was kind of testing the waters, but, you know, he was hearing it all in one place at one time. And I didn't melt, and he didn't melt, you know. And I didn't have to drink during it. You know, that was amazing. You know, during the fear parts, I just read my fears out, you know. And I learned that a lot of them, you know, I learned some funny stuff. I learned that, yeah, I'm afraid of dying, but I'm even more afraid of living, you know. I'm afraid of girls, but I'm even more afraid of living without them. You know, I'm afraid of drinking, but I'm even, you know, I'm afraid of not drinking. And the reason that was is because, like it's been said over and over again, I was relying on self. When I have fears on both ends, you know, and I'm holding on to both those, there's no place for me to hold on to God. You know, and I had never seen that before. You know, I probably had heard people say that exact thing in meetings, but I never felt it. And for the first time, I felt that, you know, that I need God. And, that I'm safe and protected, you know, and then on the, yeah, I'm going to talk about sex, you know, on the sex section, when I did my first Fifth Step, that was not about relationships, that section for me, that was about sex, that's just my experience. Later on, yeah, it becomes about relationships, but I had to get some of that other trash out of the way first, and you know, I used to have a real problem with dishonesty. Sometimes I still do. But, you know, I went through the stuff I had written. And after I read it to him, I had to go back to my sponsor at that same time and be like, well, this and this isn't true. And this is true. You know, because a lot of it was complete lies. You know, a lot of it was embellishing the parts that I wanted to look cool. And the other parts where I'm not going to tell it because it, you know, I felt horrible. And you know, and I'm glad I did it that day, you know. And the step ends, in this hour long, you know, period of like thinking, am I, you know, going back through the steps that I've already done, thinking, is there anything missing? You know, the book talks about, you know, are the blocks in place or whatever. We're building this spiritual arch. And, you know, I was sitting at his apartment. He was in the other room and I was just searching myself and, you know, asking God, like, is there anything else? And I was as honest as I could be at that moment. Yeah, there were some things that later on I would get more honest about, but it was my first beginning and you know, that honesty that I'd never experienced before. All right. And I want to switch gears now a little bit. And, you know, that was my experience, saying my Fifth Step, but then I've had experiences hearing Fifth Steps, and I don't always hear a lot of talk about that. And I think it's really important, you know, because I was frightened. Even though I knew my experience, I still thought I had to like save the guys that I heard their Fifth Step. I thought I had to say everything right. I thought like if I missed something, like they were going to go drink and it was going to be all my fault. And you know, again, I came to that realization that I'm just a drunk. I'm doing my best. You know, I try to let God in when I'm hearing a Fifth Step. And basically, I think my job when I'm hearing a Fifth Step is to be there, be in the moment, you know, if I have experience on that type of resentment, that type of fear, that type of sex conduct, I can share about that, you know. If I think the guy's totally fooling himself and can't see his part, you know, I try to point that out. And if I keep it that simple, it's really cool, you know. You know, as far as like a fifth step, the not telling anybody what I've heard is big, because I know that was important for me. You know, I didn't want, so I always mention that, you know, is like, I want to do this in complete confidence. I'm not going to tell my sponsor. I'm not going to tell any of my friends. You know, I'm not going to, that's really important, because this is a time where we got to get to the truth. And sometimes the truth is scary at first, you know. You know, and as far as like, I love it when sponsees, they start reading their fifth step in their first column, and they're talking about what happened, and they'll want to go on for like 10 minutes about one resentment. And I'm like, what did you write on the paper? You know, read that to me. Because usually the truth is pretty simple, you know, and usually it can be expressed in a couple sentences. And if it can't be, then there's still some resentment there. That's just my experience. You know, the fifth step, it says admitted, you know, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of wrongs. And it's that admitted, very, you know, basically like in the first step that Lee was talking about, I have to admit to myself, my innermost self, that I have these defects, that I have these, so that they can be released, you know. But if I'm still blaming what I did on other people, I'm not going to have a clear admission, you know, and it's going to be hazy, and it's going to be, I did this because they did that, and you know, and back and forth. And, you know, when I hear a fifth step, I try to, like, make sure it's clear. You know, and as I'm listening to the resentments, I'm listening for fears, because the next section is fears. And I try to relate the fears that I hear and the resentments to the fears that are just written out. And usually those fears come up in the sex conduct, too. You know, after I did my fifth step, it took, I don't know, like 3 hours, 4 hours, something like that. It was on Valentine's Day. I went home and I took a nap, because I was always taking naps, like my first year of sobriety, year and a half, like always. You know, I thought I was going to be like emotionally beat down. I thought I was going to have to, like, you know, just like sleep for days and eat ice cream and just whatever, you know. And I wasn't. I went to an NA Valentine's dance and had a blast. You know, I was free, you know. And it really brings to my mind, like, the spiritual dance that we all do with each other and with God. You know, it's just, the fifth step is amazing. I felt like I was finally part of this fellowship. Because I had heard in meetings, whenever I was working on steps in the beginning, every meeting I went to was about that step. You know, if I was doing step one, every meeting was about step one. When I was doing step five, you know, and four, like, every step, every meeting I went to was about those steps. And, it doesn't take many meetings to hear the people that don't do step five, you know, and are sitting on that step four, you know, or people that do step five, but they're not honest. And I did my best to learn from their experiences. And then I heard the people that had done the step and felt free, you know. They were going through the other steps, and they had positive experiences. And that's what I tried to hold on to, because I didn't want to do step five. You know, if it was up to me, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I would have held on to that stuff, hid, gone to meetings late and, you know, like left early and all that stuff that I'd done, and kept drinking. And I didn't want that anymore. You know, so if anybody hasn't done step five, I suggest get a sponsor and do it. And if anybody's, you know, sitting on a step four, I at least sat on my step four for like 20 minutes. It was like as long as it took me to drive to my sponsor's house, because, and that worked for me. You know, I really have no idea how long I've been up here. How long have I been up? Okay. I don't know how much else I have to say. You know, I love hearing fifth steps, because, like, if there's a favorite step I have doing with sponsees, it's a fifth step, because I love the mix of, like, you know, the happy emotions, the sad emotions, and to see the growth. You know, it's so cool to, like, to take a guy through the steps that when you first started working with him, all he did was talk about his problems and how everything was everyone else's fault, and go on until I'm like, all right, whatever, bye, you know. And then hear them express in words, you know, not just on paper, but express in words how they can actually, like, see that they were causing the chaos in their life. Because I'd never been able to see that before. You know, and I don't know. It's just amazing. I'm not going to talk anymore because if I do, I'll just be rambling. So thank you.
We now have gone through the first five steps, and we like to culminate with what we've gone through with someone who has gone through the steps and actually is going to tell their story. We call it a testimonial. This young man, he's actually spoken at the 164 Group Speaks on Thursday nights, so I've had the opportunity to hear his story. It is a wonderful story of hope, of miracles, and as we all are, our own stories shed that in God's grace in all of us. And it's a pleasure for me to introduce this young man, Mr. Tim H.
Tim, I'm an alcoholic. I want to start off by thanking Alex for giving me an extra 15 minutes. Thank you. my name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 10th, 2011. I have a sponsor, and I'm available to sponsor others. So basically, I mean, this is my first time doing, I guess, a testimonial, but from what he said, it's basically just a shorter, condensed version of my story. So I guess like every other time I've spoken, I guess I'll just start from the beginning. I was born in Buffalo, New York, December 7th, 1991. I grew up in a very normal family. Like, I grew up with very good morals, that knew the difference between right and wrong. To kind of tell my parents' history, I mean, my mom, from like 1986 to about 91, she's a deputy attorney general of New York State. From the time I was born up until basically the time we moved to Florida in 2000, she was the deputy attorney general of the Western District of New York. And my dad was the chief deputy investigator of the Buffalo Police Department. So, I mean, like, law enforcement is a big part of my family. I grew up with very good morals. They always told me the difference between right and wrong. And, I mean, everything was happy. I have two younger brothers. Actually, I forgot to mention, I am adopted. That has a big part to do with my Aunt Kathleen on my mother's side. She was basically kind of like the chief nurse in charge of giving birth to me and everything. So she played a great big hand into putting me into the family I'm a part of today. Childhood was very normal. Played sports. Hockey was a big thing, especially living up in New York. I played soccer in the off season, baseball. Everything was very normal, very happy. I can't think of a bad moment in my early life. My younger brothers can attest to that also. I mean, we just had a very great life there in New York. Every year when we got old enough, like once my brothers kind of reached like 4 or 5, we'd always make trips down to Florida, go to Disney World, we'd have family trips every year. Once we actually moved down to Florida, because Dennis Vaca, who's actually the attorney general at the time, lost his job, lost the election, and therefore like my parents lost their jobs also, so that's why we moved down here. My dad stuck with law enforcement. My mom wanted to spend more time with us, like her kids. So she actually became an English teacher at a technical institute, teaching foreigners who came to the country how to speak English. Basically, she kind of forfeited, like, a lot of her income just to spend time with us. She also worked at a school, like I said, and so she had the same schedule as us. So basically, whenever we were off school, she was off, and I mean, she was always there for us. She was, I mean, just a wonderful mother. Once we moved down to Florida, we'd always, like every year, we'd make trips, family trips every summer. We'd always drive all up and down the Eastern Seaboard, go to different parks like Daniel Boone or kind of drawing a blank on a bunch of other names. But we'd go from like north to South Carolina, all the way up to like Virginia, Michigan, and we'd always end up back in Buffalo, New York to see family for about a week or so. And then we'd drive all the way back, stopping at other campsites. Camping was a big thing in our family. I can actually thank my mother for that. Like, it wasn't necessarily my dad who was real big on it. My mom was the one who really loved the outdoors and stuff. And it was her idea when we were young to like go buy like a pop-up camper and go camping and just make a three-week trip out of it. Kind of fast forwarding a little bit, in 2001, I don't know if this plays any role in like how I became an alcoholic or not, but in early 2001, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. At first, I was really naive to the situation. I mean, at the time, I think I was about 8 years old when she was diagnosed. I didn't really know the seriousness of the situation. For the first couple years, from what I've talked to my dad about and everything, it never really got all that serious. She did go through chemotherapy and stuff. She went through the whole losing her hair and that. But me being 8, 9 years old, I didn't understand the whole gravity of the situation. And after about two and a half years, after going through chemotherapy and everything, she went into remission. And, at that point, I was starting to kind of get exactly, what cancer was and, how serious it was. But, by that point, it had already gone into remission, so, I didn't really think anything of it. Also, around this time, back to me and my brothers, back in Bradenton, too, that's where we were living, Bradenton, Florida. We were still heavily involved in, sports and baseball, football, soccer, basically everything. Both my parents were heavily involved in that. I was big in Boy Scouts also. My brothers at the time were big in Cub Scouts. One thing my mom was very proud of was the fact that all of us were in Scouts because she'd help plan camping trips and stuff because, like I said earlier, she's really big on that. She had her, both my parents had their hands in everything we did. My dad would help coach our soccer and baseball teams. My mom would help run, concession stands and everything while we were out in the field. She helped run, the Boy Scout troop I was in. And, everything was, just great. I really can't come up with any complaints from my earlier childhood like that. By the time, let me see one second. Fast forwarding to, late 2003, early 2004, the cancer did come back. This time, it spread rapidly. It started back in her breast again. Within, I think, probably about 6-7 months, it spread to her lung and then to her brain. January 15th, 2005, that's when my mother passed away from cancer. One thing that was a really tough part to deal with, especially in the months leading up to it. This was kind of the big, awakening for me that this really was a serious situation. When she was going through the chemotherapy and she started, lose her hair and everything, I remember there was one morning I was just kind of sitting in our living room, and all of a sudden she comes out with, a shaver, and she comes and asks me to follow her out to the back porch, and at that point, she asked, she was just sick of, like, kind of shedding hair everywhere and just asked me to shave the rest of her hair off. And basically, like, the second I turned on the razor, I just started bawling, crying. And, I couldn't do it. That's when I realized, like, finally realized how serious this was. And, like, to this point, it kind of still baffles me that it took me, like, almost 4 years to finally realize the gravity of the situation. But, I mean, once I realized that, it was probably, it was only like a few months until she passed away. To note on this, my mom was probably she was the most spiritual person in the family. We grew up in the Catholic Church. We went to church every Sunday, every Christmas, Easter. We went to CCD classes all the way up until, I want to say it's like eighth grade. She actually, I think, taught the third or fourth grade class for about 2 years. My dad, after all that happened, I'm not really sure how spiritual he is now, but I know he was spiritual back then. But my mom was the kind of foundation of the family for going to church and everything. After her death, I definitely had the conception of a higher power. It was more of a, like, a Santa Claus type thing. Like, kind of growing up, like, I was told, like, if you pray for things, like, it'll happen. Like, God's just kind of like this genie or something like that. I just kind of had a false sense of faith. And basically, like, once my mom passed away, that's really when I started kind of blaming things around me, especially God. From that point on, as you probably tell, things just kind of went downhill from there. Even to this point, it was like I was 13 when she died, and it was still about 3 years until I actually tried drinking for the first time. But from that point on, I became totally self-sufficient. I definitely distanced myself from my family. I tried any way possible to kind of stay away from my dad, because at this point, after like the initial first couple months after her passing away, we had like a lot of family around, and everyone was trying to help us in any way they could. We had family, friends that lived around us that would cook food and bring it over basically on a nightly basis. And I mean, we just had a lot of great friends. My mom had a lot of great friends that really did love her. And I mean, after kind of those first couple months ended, that's when things really kind of started to get real around the house, that we finally realized that, like, my mom had passed away and that life really has to change right now. And for probably, like, the first year or so, my dad really had a hard time handling it because, he had been married to my mom for 20-plus years. They raised me, raised my two younger brothers, and even my older half-brother that's my dad's son, before he actually married my mom, she helped raise him also. So basically, like, he had never really been alone when it came to raising kids, let alone four of them. Needless to say, it was very stressful on my dad, very stressful on me and my brothers. Looking back on it, I used to blame my dad for a lot of things, but considering the circumstances, I don't know how I would have handled that situation either. During this time, my dad was very temperamental, very short-winded. Like, it didn't really take much to kind of get him angry or whatever. Like, I mean, he was never really the type to lay a hand on any of us, but, like, verbally and stuff, I mean, it got kind of stressful around the house. So, I mean, that kind of leads me back to how I was trying to be self-sufficient to the best of my ability. From the time I was 14, I got a job working almost 40 hours a week. At this time, I was very involved in Boy Scouts. I mean, even up to this day, that's probably the busiest I've ever been. I was working basically every weeknight. On weekends, probably once a month, I'd go on a weekend camping trip with the Boy Scouts. I was involved in school. I was going to clubs. I was part of the National Junior Honor Society. And that's one thing I should mention, too. Like, I've always been the one in the family who did very well in school and didn't really even have to put that much effort into it. And I can definitely attribute that to my mom. She was the one who had a lot of background in school, going to college, being a lawyer and all that. My dad never went to college. He's been in law enforcement for almost 40 years now. And back when he started, like, he didn't have to have a college degree or anything, and he started when he was 18. At this point, I was the busiest I'd ever been. And at the same time, this is kind of where my brothers kind of started to, I wouldn't necessarily say fall apart, but they needed a lot more help in school, Now it was, more my responsibility to help them the best of my ability. From the age of 13, I basically had to be the other parent, at least in my eyes, that's how it was. And, I had to take on a lot of responsibility. And, people even tell me this today, from the time, I went to high school, I was hanging out with kids and stuff that were 4 or 5 years older than I am. And I mean, even today, I'm 21 right now. And when people ask me, for some reason, they always think I'm 24 and no other number. It always comes to 24 for some reason. But that's true. From my experience, I'd have to act more mature to prove myself to the others around me that, I could handle what was going on in my life. All right, and then, so I don't waste a little bit more time. I'll just kind of get to the whole drinking part. After about 3 years, my dad started dating again. Her name is Kelly. She's actually my stepmom right now. They dated for about a year, and they ended up getting married. I think it was September 1st in 2008. Basically, my whole view on the situation was she was just there to replace my mom. And, in some aspects, that's true, but not in the way I was thinking about it. My dad did need companionship, but by no means was he there just to replace my mom. But that's the way I thought about it. And the night of their wedding, September 1st, 2008, that was the first time I got drunk. They went off on their honeymoon for a couple nights. My older brother, Brendan, my half-brother, was there to watch us. And so it was basically me, my older cousin, and my neighbor. And I remember, the first thing I drank was, actually it was a big concoction of different things. There was gin, vodka, whiskey, and stuff like that. But I remember specifically that all we had to chase it was milk. So, according to Bill's story, I guess I'm heading down the right path already. From that point on, I drank to get drunk. There was really no in between, because once I felt that first feeling, there was really nothing that could compare to it. And, I mean, at this time, I was, I think, late 16. So, where am I? Okay, so after that, I tried to find that whenever possible. I mean, at the time, for me being 16, it was definitely hard to find alcohol whenever I wanted it. So, I mean, weekend parties definitely became a must. Very, very quickly after that, I think within a month, I was introduced to pot. For me, like, the big thing was, I mean, convenience. Like, if I could do it all the time, that's absolutely great. If not, like, I just kind of feel screwed. But, like, weed at the beginning became basically an everyday thing. But I honestly, like, just could not wait to get drunk at parties because, I mean, there's really nothing that really compared to that. And, I mean, at the beginning, like, I didn't really see any consequences. I mean, from the very beginning, I drove drunk. I didn't really see anything wrong with that. And I didn't really see any other option. Like, I had to get somewhere to sleep. I wasn't about to sleep in a bush or on some random person's couch that I didn't know. But, I mean, as time progressed, and, like, I mean, I'll mention this now, like, being 16, like, for me, drugs play almost as big a role as alcohol did. I mean, this, I mean, I wouldn't take anything back, but, I mean, being 16, like, they ID for alcohol. Drug dealers don't ID to sell you drugs. So, I mean, for me, like, I mean, like I said earlier, like, it was just based on, like, absolute convenience. And going back to the whole self-sufficient thing, trying to stay away from the house as much as possible, being able to, being intoxicated while at the house opened up a whole new door. Because that way I can actually stand being around my family and not have to go to other places to kind of get away from them and myself. So, I mean, I was talking earlier about how I was an honor roll student, National Junior Honor Society and everything. And that, I mean, that continued basically all throughout high school. But from the first time I took a drink, like, it was basically the beginning of my junior year. By the time my senior year started, actually halfway through junior year, my grades dropped tremendously. I mean, probably, like, the first half of my junior year, I had probably, like, a 3.5, 3.6, 3.7 grade point average. By the end of that year, it dropped down to a 3.0. And by the end of my senior year, it was still a 3.0, but all my motivation had lost. And I switched from all honors classes to basically, like, the minimum requirements that were allowed in high school. I was taking 4 shop classes. Going from pre-calculus, dual enrollment, college credit class to math I was doing in second grade. I forgot to mention this earlier. Like, one of my biggest passions at that time, and one thing I've actually gained back in sobriety, is from the time I was in sixth grade, I started playing the violin, and that was one thing my mother was very proud of, my dad, basically my whole family. And my senior year, after excelling in that, being like first chair all throughout high school, I dropped it. I really had no motivation to stick with it. I ended up replacing that with one of the shop classes because shop was very easy, didn't really require anything, and allowed me to skip because that was adding that one extra class made it exactly half my day. So I think I was probably absent for probably the second half of the day for about half the school year. So after that, I mean, by that time, there were other substances that came into the mix. Still drinking whenever possible, getting loaded on weekends, blacking out. I can't really remember much of my senior year, to be honest. By the end of the senior year, everyone was starting to apply for colleges, going off, and really the only reason I did it was because everyone else was doing it. I really had no motivation to go to college whatsoever. My plan was just to kind of maybe stick to a community college there in Bradenton. But for whatever reason, I applied to USF and got in. And from hearing other people's stories, I mean, I was about to say not to compare myself to them, but that's exactly what I'm going to do. My whole first year at USF, let's start off with the summer semester. That was the only two classes I actually completed. I got a C in one and a D in the other. I did the absolute bare minimum. I probably did less than the minimum, but somehow I still passed it. Once the rest of the year started, the fall semester, I think it took less than a month before I just quit going to my classes altogether. I tell people, like, yeah, I went to USF, I was a business major, but, like, in reality, like, I went to class. Well, actually, I didn't even go to classes. I was just enrolled in them. I wasn't even, like, smart. Like, I hear people tell their stories about their college experience and stuff, and, like, I hear them talking about how they withdraw from classes so that way they get the money back, but I had no idea about that, so it kind of made me mad about that for a little while. The fall semester, it took me probably a month to just quit going to classes altogether. And I think for the spring semester, it took maybe 2 weeks. That was my motivation level. Needless to say, I didn't do any of the assignments. The last few months, I ended up going to rehab about a month before the year ended. The last semester, I mean, that's where I was hitting my bottom. I could not get out of bed in the morning unless I knew there was even the slightest chance of me getting drunk or finding a party or getting a fix one way or another. And I mean, that's how my days went. I'd sleep in till 4 in the afternoon. If I couldn't find what I wanted, I'd just sit, like, in the dorm lobby just watching TV until I went to bed, and I'd wake up the next day doing the same thing. At this time, like, I was stealing stuff from everyone and everything around me. One of, like, the bigger financial amends I have to make is to, Best Buy. Like, I've stolen thousands of dollars worth of merchandise from them. I've stolen thousands of dollars from my parents, different roommates and stuff in the dorms. And I just had no compassion for anyone around me. There was something I was going to say. On 4/20 of 2010, My brother actually found some supplies in my car that aren't very good, and he brought it to my parents. And this wasn't the first time my dad realized like I had an addiction problem. And this was a little bit before I actually went to college. Like he actually took me to like a family therapist. Or actually at this time, like, he didn't realize I actually had a drug problem. But, he noticed, like, how much I was stealing from him and stuff, and he just wanted to get to the bottom of it. So he took me to a family therapist, and that's actually the first time I came clean and honest about what I was doing, like how much I was drinking, how much I was using drugs and stuff like that. Okay. He took me to a family therapist, and they didn't teach me anything about AA or anything. Basically, they told me about geographical cures, changed the people I hang out with and everything, and really it didn't really do anything. So coming into rehab and recovery for the first time, I mean, it was definitely a big change. I went to my first meeting, I believe it was a men's meeting, that's on Friday nights, and honestly, like, I liked what I saw. Like, I saw all these people that I could relate to, and they were happy, and they weren't drinking, doing drugs, or anything like that. For some reason, and, like, this is important to me, there's actually one part I wanted to read out of the book. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And that's exactly where I was. Like, I went through 90 days of day treatment and went to, like, a three-quarter halfway house for another month. And in that time, like, I convinced myself I didn't have a problem. Like, because, I mean, before, like, my definition of sobriety was just switching to something else and staying away from what was giving me consequences. So actually staying away from everything for roughly 4 months made me think, like, I just don't belong here. And, I mean, not to mention, at the time, like, I was the youngest person in the rehab by probably 5-6 years, and they didn't really take us to any of the young people's groups that you see around here. So, I felt alone. So I ended up going back out, and I quickly realized that really nothing changed. I mean, if anything, it got worse right away. I mean, I probably went back out for about 2 weeks, and the amount of, like, mental torture and everything I put myself through was back to where it was from the last day I was out to like, probably tenfold. Like, having that, like, hope and everything that I had learned in AA in my head while I was back out, I mean, it seriously ruined everything. I mean, not to say that it was good to begin with, but, I mean, it ruined, like, the little bit of hope that I had for it. I still had the same sponsor I was with. But, I mean, this time, like, I had that fear and desperation that the book talks about. And I worked diligently on the steps. I think we finished them within a couple of few weeks. I mean, step one, I mean, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become manageable. I mean, that was definitely the biggest turning point in my sobriety, just being able to finally admit that I'm no different from any other alcoholic in these rooms, and that basically alcohol is my master, and there's no way I can manage it if that's a part of my life. Moving on to step two, I never lost faith in I did lose faith in my higher power, but I never lost the concept of a higher power. I consider myself agnostic when I came into these rooms. One of the biggest hurdles, though, was actually, like, putting faith into that higher power, because I had no idea how to do that. Definition of faith was the whole Santa Claus genie type thing. And, I mean, I quickly realized that everything that I pray for is not going to come true. Going on to step three, especially the over to the care of God as we understood him, at the beginning, I had a hard time dealing with that. Like, I tried going back to the Christian faith. It didn't quite work for me. For me, I was just kind of reading it way too black and white. Like, the whole Jesus being able to turn water into wine thing just didn't work for me. So that's really the biggest reason I just kind of cut that whole thing altogether. I tried different methods, like my sponsor is a Buddhist. I tried doing that. Didn't work for me. I tried the other, like, little things, like making the rooms of AA or higher power and stuff. But eventually it just got to the point where I just started praying to basically nothing. Well, not nothing, but I believe there's something out there, but I just didn't know what I was praying to. And over time, over the next few months, up until probably my 6 months, where I woke up one morning and I just kind of looked back on the past 6 months and realized I had not had the thought, obsession, or anything like that to drink in 5 months, ever since I finished the steps. And that's really when things started to change for me. I started to I was already praying on a fairly regular basis, but my prayers actually had meaning behind them now, and like I felt I was actually praying to something. And kind of just to tell you exactly where I'm at today, I've been sober for about a year and 4 months now, and I mean ever since that spiritual experience I had, I've been able to allow God into my life basically in all aspects, to pretty much the best of my ability most of the time. I've been able to hold a job down since my first month of sobriety, which has never happened before. I've never been able to hold a job for more than maybe a few months. I've gotten promoted in that job. I'm getting another promotion again once a new store opens. I have a beautiful relationship with my family. They trust me, which is a big deal. I have better friends today than I ever thought would be possible. Even like before, like I started drinking and just screwing up relationships in my life, the friends I have today, or the friends I had back then, don't even compare to what the people that are in my life today. There was one more thing I wanted to read before I ended. I don't know if I can find it. Wait for it. Okay, and I know Toby can relate to this because he likes this passage also. It comes from almost the end of There is a Solution. And it is, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we can never do by ourselves. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.